WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Well, what if they held an election and nobody came? That is the embarrassment of this week's presidential vote in Egypt, where turnout has been so low, they keep extending the voting period by whole days. Partly that's because Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood was banned from the election. Not so democratic. An embarrassment, too, for the Obama administration, which says it's committed to democracy in places like Egypt. But does that commitment seem to waver when the outcome of democratic elections go against our apparent interests? This hour on Point, Egypt, its generals, its Islamists, and where America stands. What do you see in Egypt's vote? And do you prefer the tough love dictator or democracy, even if democracy brings Islamists to power? Joining me first from Cairo is Louisa Lovelock. She is Egypt correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Louisa, thanks very much. Good to have you on the broadcast.
Hi.
Hi. So, Louisa, you've been covering this election that seems to keep growing longer and longer in terms of the days committed to it. What day of the vote are we in now?
Today is day three, and turnout around the polls today is certainly very low. Egypt's Higher Election Commission has said that we've seen a turnout of around 37% so far. And that's not as low as many expected, given the sluggish turnout. But the credibility of this vote internationally has been seriously hampered by this continuous extension.
So bring us up to speed on, let's say, from last summer. Last summer, the Egyptian people had elected an Islamist president, Mohamed Morsi, who, after a period of apparent unpopularity and demonstrations on the street, was deposed by the military and by General al-Sisi, who, as you say, is now running for president. From last summer to now, what has been the story of the Muslim Brotherhood? Where do they stand, and how influential, although they're not running, how influential are they in today's vote?
Yeah, of course. As you say, President Morsi was elected with 51.7% of the vote back in 2012. Over his year in power, his popularity dipped dramatically, if he ever was as popular as his vote suggested. And a lot of people did see the Brotherhood as a democratic force in politics. So the military finally stepped in around this time last year, exactly a year ago. Since then, there's been a pretty aggressive state-led crackdown on the Brotherhood and other secular dissenters. Says around 16,000 people have been put in prison. That could be as high as 40,000, according to some counts. And the Brotherhood have been also pushed underground.
Louisa, thanks for joining us. And the only reason I'm cutting you short is because of the difficulty of the connection. And if we have the chance to reconnect with you for a better connection, I'll bring you back. I think it was probably difficult for all of our listeners to hear what you were saying. So I want to actually bring in our next guest to talk about some of what you were going to cover, and that's Shadi Hamid. He has just come out with a new book called Temptations of Power, Islamists and Illiberal Democracy in a New Middle East. Shadi, thanks very much for joining us on
Hi,
Point.
John. Thanks.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about what Louisa was trying to convey to us, which was the state of play of the Islamists in this particular election. The fact that the vote has had such low turnout. I was asking her, is this a reflection of the power of the Muslim Brotherhood, or is that irrelevant?
So the Brotherhood certainly does have the support of a significant segment of the population, but we shouldn't overstate their role in the low turnout. I think it goes much more broad than just the Brotherhood or their supporters. There's a general kind of apathy among the Egyptian public. They've had close to 10 different elections over the past 3 years. They keep on going to the polls, but things don't seem to get better. The country is getting less stable, not more stable. So I think there's a disillusion. But also, we have to look at the context of these elections. These are not meaningful elections. We shouldn't talk about them as if they're part of normal democratic politics. Everyone knew the result before the voting started. So in that sense, it's more like a coronation. Mm-hmm. To kind of give legitimacy to this new political order, to give legitimacy to former Field Marshal Sisi. So, I mean, why should you vote if you know what the result is going to be and there's no real competition? There was a second candidate, but he wasn't a very serious contender. And in any case, the room for expressing opposition in the new Egypt is very limited in terms of access to the media, and protests are effectively banned. So this is not the kind of context where people are going to feel excited about the choices they have at the ballot box.
So really the question that this is leading to is sort of whatever happened to Egyptian democracy in the wake of Arab Spring, where 3 years ago the narrative was that a dictator had been overthrown, the people were being put in charge, or the people were taking charge. There was an election. The election, I think, was by and large seen to be fair. And the other part of the question we want to explore is the role of the United States and the perception that it has in Egypt and also the perception here at home. But I want to begin with a little bit of a very, very short clip from an interview from the election this week where a working class woman named Mona Hanem, who was supporting General Sisi, went viral with what she said a few months back when she gave this advice to President Obama.
Egyptian women, you are listening to Obama? Shut up your mouth, Obama. Shut up your mouth, Obama. Sisi, yes, Sisi, yes. Morsi, no, Morsi, no.
So what does that say? I mean, that woman's obviously a supporter of General Sisi and seems to be implying that President Obama was a big backer of the Brotherhood, Muslim Brotherhood guy. How did things get so, you know, twisted out of shape?
Yes, this is one of the key questions, and I was in Tahrir Square on February 11th, 2011, when Mubarak fell, and it was such a euphoric moment to be there and to see the crowd erupting in cheers when the announcement was made. And it's very striking to look at how far Egypt has gone from that just in mere 3 years' time. So something very, I think, dark has happened here, and you have a situation where Egyptians voted for the Muslim Brotherhood several times, but then the Brotherhood lost popularity, and you see a segment of the population, a big segment of the population, supporting a military coup, which happened last July, and then, most troubling, supporting the mass killing of their fellow countrymen. We had what Human Rights Watch calls the worst mass killing in modern Egyptian history on August 14th. Mm-hmm. So something very dark has happened. And Egyptians have turned against each other in a way that we haven't seen for a very long time. I mean, under Mubarak, he was repressive, but you never saw this aspect of Egyptians turning against each other, citizen against citizen, father against son, brother against brother. So that kind of the tearing of the social fabric, that's new for Egypt. Now, in terms of the U.S. role here, there is a perception among supporters of the Egyptian military that Obama and the U.S. have been supporting the Muslim Brotherhood.
But how did that come to be?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to take seriously, and it's a product of a lot of conspiracy theories, and it's something you hear repeatedly in Egypt. But the funny thing is when you talk to Brotherhood supporters, they say the exact opposite, that the U.S. supported the military coup. And they see the U.S. as complicit in the very repressive crackdown we're seeing now. So I think the Obama administration has managed somehow to alienate both sides of the Egyptian divide. And Egyptians seem to think that the U.S. is supporting whoever their enemy happens to be at any given time. Now, I think that it's fair to say that the U.S. did support, at least earlier on, the democratic process, and they were willing to respect that Mohamed Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood won the presidential elections in 2012. But the problem is in Egypt, sometimes when you support the democratic process, people take that to mean you support the Brotherhood because the Brotherhood is the group most likely to win in a free and fair election.
Let's listen to what the president said last summer. You raised the question, how could they possibly be thinking we're on both sides and have both sides angry at us? This was the president responding soon after President Morsi was deposed from power.
Given the depths of our partnership with Egypt, our national security interests in this pivotal part of the world, and our belief that engagement can support a transition back to a democratically elected civilian government, we've sustained our commitment to Egypt and its people. But while we want to sustain our relationship with Egypt, our traditional cooperation cannot continue as usual when civilians are being killed in the streets and rights are being rolled back.
So, Shadi Hamid, you can sort of think that actually he's on both sides or on neither side with a statement like that. I don't think a great deal of clarity emerges from that policy statement.
Yes, this is part of the problem with U.S. policy in Egypt and the Middle East more generally. There's really this sense of splitting the middle, that the Obama administration has avoided taking bold positions. But what that ends up doing, it confuses a lot of people in the region, and that lack of clarity allows people to kind of make their own determinations. So you have people who can make the opposite arguments simultaneously. And even in the statement that we just heard from Obama, that wasn't really a clarification of policy. Yes, there was some criticism of the government's repression, but that's rhetoric. If you look at the actual policies, the U.S. hasn't put serious pressure on the Egyptian military since the coup, even though, as Obama himself said, they're killing innocent civilians on the street. So I think we also have to look at the gap between rhetoric and policy, and that gap has only grown larger over the last year.
I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook. We are talking about Egypt and how it overthrew a dictator, voted in a Muslim Brotherhood president, and then returned to dictatorship. My guest is Shadi Hamid. He is a fellow at the Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World at the Brookings Institution's Saban Center. He is also author of a new book, Temptations of Power, Islamists and a Liberal Democracy in a New Middle East. And Shadi, you recently spoke at a panel discussion in New York, which was organized by Oxford University Press. And in that, you said something about a lot of the analysis that's done here in the U.S. and maybe the West in general about Islamist politicians in the Middle East. Here's a little bit of what you said then.
I think it's unfortunate that there are people who write articles or maybe even books sometimes about Islamist groups, and they haven't even met a real live member of the group they're writing about.
So, Shadi, you have met real-life members of the Muslim Brotherhood. That was the method of your book. Give us 25 to 30 seconds on the research that you did and why it was distinct and unique.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. This book was really 10 years in the making. I lived in Jordan and Egypt over the course of that period and made a lot of field research trips. And really, I wanted to take seriously this notion that to understand Islamists, you have to do something very simple. You have to sit down with them, talk to them, get to know them, understand their fears and aspirations. We don't have to agree or like Islamist groups, but we do have to understand them. And these are, after all, real people with real ideas and real religious beliefs. And I think that we have to take those beliefs seriously and try to understand them. So I tried to track the evolution of Islamist groups over a rather long period of time from the late 70s until really 2013. Mm-hmm. And I make a couple arguments about how Islamists change over time. I kind of argue against the academic and conventional wisdom that repression can have a moderating effect on Islamist groups. And the flip side of that is that more democracy can actually push Islamist groups further to the right towards greater conservatism. And this goes against, I think, what a lot of people think, that once you have a democratic opening, Islamists will move to the center, they'll become more moderate, and everything will go along this linear trajectory towards liberal democracy and all the things that we want and like as Americans. But I wanted to problematize that notion. Good things don't necessarily go together. And you might actually have a situation where more democracy in a country like Egypt means less liberalism.
Well, as you say, I mean, President Bush's freedom agenda for the Middle East, about which he was entirely sincere, he boiled down, you quote him as, in fact, at one point, as talking about the fact that when you're in power and you have to make the decisions and the people are counting on you, that you're going to become a lot more focused on fixing potholes than in blowing up buildings. With this whole notion, therefore, that being in power is a moderating influence. And you're saying not so much with the Muslim Brotherhood.
Sure. Well, that's a great quote from George W. Bush from 2005. And that really shows how much these ideas have become part of our popular discourse, to the extent that the president is talking about what we might call the pothole theory of democracy. Now, in the case of the Muslim Brotherhood and countries like Egypt, We're talking about societies that are deeply conservative, where large majorities support various aspects of Sharia law, whether it's on the role of women, on the role of minorities, on religiously derived criminal punishments, on the question of whether the state should be neutral or should it stand for a kind of religious ideal. And I think that because you have broad support for these kinds of illiberal sentiments, in a democracy, if you're elected, you have to be responsive to those sentiments and you have to reflect what the voters and your constituents want. And this is a situation we have with groups like the Brotherhood. And in a democratic setting, they no longer have a monopoly on the Islamist vote. You have other parties that come to the fore, namely here ultra-conservative Salafi groups. So the Salafi groups here and they're dragging the Brotherhood further to the right. And in the book, I call this the Tea Party effect. So this isn't totally unique to the Arab world. It's something we see here in our own country, where the Republican Party, which is ostensibly supposed to be a center-right party in the mainstream, has been dragged increasingly in a more conservative direction.
You also argue in the book that repression of the Muslim Brotherhood actually was the thing that resulted in its moderation, that it became more moderate, that it began to talk about the need to abide with the mechanisms of democracy. The more it was repressed and the more it was on the run, the more it was in trouble as a survival tactic. And that almost comes out with the syllogism that that the best policy to make the Muslim Brotherhood more moderate is to repress them. And the worst policy is to give them a place in the polls, because once they had power, in the case of Egypt with Morsi, they became, as you said, more illiberal. Does it boil down to that?
Yeah, it's this part of my argument that's a little bit more controversial. So I'm not saying that repression always has a moderating effect, but in the specific cases that I look at in the book, it did, in my view, have a moderating effect, and I lay out the reasons why. But we have to kind of distinguish between the sort of eradicationist policies we're seeing in Egypt now, where they're trying to destroy the Brotherhood altogether. That's an entirely different matter. And what I looked at was a period in time in Egypt, for example, where the former president Mubarak was becoming more oppressive, but there was never really a desire to eradicate the Brotherhood entirely. But the basic idea here, though, is that you realize how important democracy is when it's something you're being deprived of. Banning alcohol or segregating the sexes doesn't seem so important when you don't have basic freedom. So over the 1990s and 2000s, Islamist groups across the region really came to this basic realization of how fundamental at least a minimal level of freedom and democracy was, because you can't do anything else without that. And they also wanted to demonstrate to international audiences, especially during the Bush Freedom Agenda, that, listen, we're not extremists like Al-Qaeda. We're different. We're becoming more moderate. So the international factors are important here. And groups like the Brotherhood are surprisingly sensitive to what Western audiences think of them.
They care.
So they were trying to promote this more moderate image as well, and also trying to ally with liberal and leftist groups, because their main goal was to unseat the dictator, Mubarak in this case, and they realized they couldn't do that without the support and backing of other parties in the Egyptian landscape.
Okay, so you're saying that they actually care what the Americans think and what the White House thinks and what President Obama thinks, the Muslim Brotherhood. So what message did the Brotherhood get during its year in power? What message did Mohamed Morsi get during its year in power from President Obama?
Well, in retrospect, they would say now that the U.S. was trying to undermine them and didn't give them as much support as they deserved as the elected government. But part of that is revisionist history. I mean, they see everything now in the context of the coup, and they're very bitter about that, obviously. I think that the U.S. was playing a very difficult balancing act. They were trying to support a democratic process, but they didn't also want to appear to be taking sides and supporting the Brotherhood against other groups. And that's a very challenging thing to do in a very polarized context. But I just also wanted to mention, to get to one of your previous points about how Americans should look at this, even if democracy makes Islamists more illiberal, that doesn't mean democracy is bad. I mean, I'm a big believer that we have to respect democratic outcomes even if we don't like them, that democracy is about the right to make the wrong choice.
But don't. But Shadi, our concept of democracy is broader than the mechanism of voting. It goes to, for the most obvious example, the rights of women. So, can you define what you mean by democracy? Because obviously, the Muslim Brotherhood is not gonna strike a point for women in the way that we would understand it to be democratic.
Well, this is where I think I try to make an important distinction between democracy and liberalism, and we as Americans tend to see them as going together because of our own history. First, we had the foundation of constitutional liberalism, and then and only then, at a later point in our history, we had democracy in the sense of universal suffrage. So for us, when we say democracy, it really means liberal democracy in our own American context. But in other societies and other cultures, you don't necessarily have the same thing. And it's not as if this is the Middle East is the first time this has happened. In India, hundreds of millions of Indians voted for a fundamentally illiberal party, a far-right Hindu nationalist party. And we can look at other examples, Chavez and Venezuela. The list goes on.
And so did the Nazis. Let's remember that as well, a half century ago. Let me bring in some of our listeners. Bill is calling in from Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Bill. You're on Point.
Hello there.
Hi.
I think that the United States should have respected the democratic process, and I don't believe they did. I do think they did try to undermine once the election was over, and that the people here in the United States were making a lot of noise about the Muslim Brotherhood, and I really think that that was part of the downfall. And I think the United States may have had some type of influence over the Egyptian army also.
Do you find it interesting, Bill, that woman we heard earlier in the broadcast, that voter, was actually arguing the other way, that the United States was supporting the Muslim Brotherhood?
I do. Well, I think the president, President Obama, wanted to respect that, but I think he was getting a lot of issues thrown at him, that if we support the Muslim Brotherhood, that we're supporting a bad group, so to speak.
All right. Thanks, Bill, for your call. I mean, it sounds like it's a real situation of very, very mixed messages from the White House. And to talk about that a little bit, and Shadi, if you can hang on for a minute, I want to bring in Robin Wright, an old friend and a frequent guest on Point, joining us now. She's a journalist and author and a fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Woodrow Wilson International Center and author of Rock the Casbah. Robin Wright, welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you, John.
Robin, the point that Bill just made and that I just made as well, that the signals do seem very mixed from the White House on whether it stands by the democracy such as it is in Egypt or not. Take us through the pattern of the wavering pattern, I think, of American commitment to the process in Egypt.
Well, the president at West Point today actually talked a little bit about Egypt, and he made points that reflect the kind of ambiguity out of the White House. He said that the United States acknowledges that its relationship with Egypt is anchored in security interests, meaning the peace treaty with Israel specifically, as well as the shared effort against terrorism. He also said that the United States does not intend to cut off its cooperation with the new government, but that it will continue to persist for openings and freedom for the people. So it's taking this middle road. It's a stark contrast to the earlier Obama speech and actions when Egypt was in crisis over the protests against former President Hosni Mubarak, when President Obama took one of the most interesting and pivotal changes in U.S. foreign policy in arguably 60 years, when he sided with democracy rather than stability. It was a definitive turn in U.S. foreign policy. And now we appear to be slipping back into the previous preference for stability over democracy. And the speech at West Point today did not clarify that in any sense.
If the U.S. is stepping back from its commitment to the democratic process in Egypt, is that a wise move, or is that a loss?
I think it's a terrible loss. This is a pivotal moment. The Arab world has, over the last 3 years, gone through a very traumatic process of challenging autocratic rule. It's the last block of countries to hold out against the democratic tide that has swept the rest of the world over the last 30, 35 years. And it was an important turning point. And the United States was not consistent in its support of democracy. It supported it in North Africa and Tunisia and Libya and Egypt and then a little bit into the Levant in Syria, but did not push that message when it came to the oil-rich countries in the Persian Gulf. So we've been inconsistent, really, from the beginning. We took the right step on Egypt in siding with the people and siding with the forces of the 21st century, the forces of history, and pushing for empowerment in its many different faces. I think it's a real loss. The fact is that the new government in Egypt is not going to be able to solve what was the core issue from the beginning of these uprisings, which was not about liberal democracy. It was about the right to jobs, the right to a sense of a future, the right to survival. That was, after all, a young fruit vendor in Tunisia who, in challenging corruption of a government official, triggered what led to the protests and sparked sympathy across the Arab world. And that still is the foremost issue in that region. It's not, who's in power. It's what kind of rights are provided in terms of daily existence.
Robin, to look at a future that did not happen, say Morsi had not been deposed by the military, and he had just blundered on in office, because that appeared to be what he was doing. He had become enormously unpopular. And there had simply been another free and fair election that the U.S. backed. Where do you think that our standing would be with the Egyptian people?
Well, it was clear that a lot of Egyptians were very unhappy with Morsi's rule. But that year, that pivotal year, was also shaped largely by the deep state that continued to rule, largely from the military. Remember, it was...
Define the term deep state.
Well, deep state are those forces in the military, the security forces, in some cases the judiciary, who used their powers to try to challenge a democratically elected president. Remember, it was the judiciary who dissolved the first democratically elected parliament in Egypt's modern history. And it was not this was a move that undermined a democratic process and led Morsi to become increasingly paranoid about what else the deep state was going to do against him. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean that Morsi was a great president or a good president, but the democratic process would have done far better in Egypt's long-term interests and in the outside world's long-term interests if he had been voted out of office instead of ousted in a military coup. Mm-hmm. I'm not convinced that this election is going to lead to any greater stability or that it will serve America's long-term interests either.
This is On Point. I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and we are talking about how democracy will grow in the Middle East or not, how Islamist politics and democracy will work together there or not, and what the U.S. should be doing to promote its ideals as well as its interests. Are we getting the balance right in Egypt or in Syria or anywhere for that matter? My guests are Shadi Hamid, he's a fellow at the Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World at the Brookings Institution, and Robin Wright, a fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Woodrow Wilson International Center. We have a lot of listeners lining up to weigh in on this topic. I want to go first to Kermit from Townsend, Vermont. Hi, Kermit. You're on Point.
Hi. You know, first, I just have to take... I'm infuriated with Egypt. I was born there. I am Egyptian. And first off, with the Western media, this problem of calling everything the Arab Spring, mm-hmm. and this is a Middle Eastern issue, these North African countries have been struggling since Arab nationalism was brought over and handed to them, and this was the big revolution back in the day. And now, all of these youthful people have been in the streets trying to get rid of this ridiculous system, these totalitarian rulers. And these youthful kids were out here doing this thing. The Muslim Brotherhood, they were nothing but opportunists. They had nothing to do with the revolution. Then they came in and they took over. And I'm ashamed that Egyptians voted them into office. It's a shame that they elected the party that killed Anwar Sadat. It doesn't matter that they said that they were reformed or whatever. They are absolutely ridiculous.
Thanks for your call, Kermit. I want to let Shadi Hamid respond to that. Shadi Hamid.
First, that's factually incorrect. The Brotherhood was not involved in Sadat's assassination, although that is part of government propaganda in Egypt and that sort of thing. But, I mean, it's not as if the Brotherhood, yes, they may be opportunists, but that's really what politics is about, opportunism, winning elections, getting out the vote. And that's what the Muslim Brotherhood did better than anyone else. And they won not just one election, but several elections, fair and square, in what was considered to be free, you know, free elections.
So you're saying saying, Shadi, that there was nothing grossly undemocratic or underhanded about the way that the Muslim Brotherhood came to power.
Which seems to be Kermit's point.
Yeah.
We can talk about their authoritarian tendencies once they were in power, but in terms of getting to power, they won elections and, you know, that's what Egyptians decided. Now, we don't have to like what Egyptians think or how they vote, but that is what they chose. And as I said before, I think there has to be some respect for that. The revolutionaries, the youth activists that the caller was mentioning, they were very good at bringing down a dictator, but they didn't really have a plan after that. They didn't know how to organize or how to build political parties. They refused to, for the most part, to become part of the electoral process. But that's the only way to play politics, ultimately, is to organize and to get people to vote for you. You can't just go to the streets indefinitely and protest 24/7. And I think that's where the revolutionaries really failed.
Jeff from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. Shadi just partially answered my first of two questions.
So just cut to the second.
I do want to ask if the military, the interim authorities hadn't jump-started the electoral process so early and there had been more of a time for party formation, if he thinks that would have made any difference. So that's the first question. The second question is, and it also relates to immaturity of the whole political.
Jeff, I'm going to cut you off there just in the interest of everybody, one question, one person. So let me have Shadi go ahead and answer that question. It's about if there had been more time for other parties to build up, would that have changed things?
Look, I think if you added 6 months or 12 months to the transition schedule, it may have made a little bit of a difference, but not dramatically so. I mean, for liberal parties to build something from scratch, that's a process that takes years or even longer. So I'm not sure how much of a difference it would have made. The Islamists and the Muslim Brotherhood in particular had a built-in organizational advantage. And I think there's also the more general question that, you know, what is liberalism in the Egyptian context? And we use the word liberal, but what we usually mean is not Islamists or groups that hate Islamists and want them out of power. But there's no real affirmative vision for liberalism. There might be a vague sentiment, but, you know, I think, you know, that's the real challenge here. And, you know, again, that takes time. That takes knocking on doors and spending and getting your hands dirty in the everyday aspects of politics.
Robin Wright at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Woodrow Wilson International Center. You and I were chatting before about the wavering and positions taken by the White House and its deep lack of clarity. But we didn't take this crack at it. The fact that the Muslim Brotherhood did not get to run in the election that's taking place this week, this somewhat failed election, is that something that should give the U.S. a sigh of relief that the Brotherhood wasn't running, or more of a twinge of regret?
Well, I think the United States had hoped that all parties legitimately supported by the Egyptian people would be allowed to run, that if they had, whether it's the number of signatures on a petition or whatever qualifications required, that they would be allowed to participate. The tragedy, I think, at the moment now is that we're in a period that there's very little that the United States can do to influence what happens next beyond the military issue, the issue of military aid, the $1.3 to $1.5 billion that the U.S. has been giving to Egypt for a long period of time. And because of the widening spread of al-Qaeda franchises in the region, whether it's in Syria or Iraq or in Libya, which is next door to Egypt, that there's a growing fear that this is the threat that, that will spill over onto American interests, on to our allies in Europe, and therefore we need strong leadership in Egypt to be an ally in fighting that terrorism. That was one of the key points that President Obama made today in his speech at West Point. And that then skews our standards when it comes to what we want to see happen politically inside Egypt. And again, we get back to this point of democracy over stability. It's Sam Huntington, the former political scientist at Harvard, wrote a very good book about the waves of democracy, that it takes three waves to actually get democracy to take root in any society in transition. And we've seen that happen throughout the world. It happened, as Shadi pointed out, in Venezuela, the first country in Latin America to become a democracy in 1952, and yet in this century it elected a military strongman who had tried to engage in a coup, military coup, just a decade earlier. Mm-hmm. That when it that democracy is something that is a luxury in most countries where poverty prevails, they literally can't afford democracy. And the challenge for us is how to use our resources, not just our political clout, in order to try to support democratic forces. It will be at least a generation before those young people who protested at Tahrir Square will have the sophistication, the political maturity, the experience, the resources, the leverage to run for office or to form alternative parties, to create real alternatives to the military or to the Muslim Brotherhood, that third way, that center, that which has been so lacking in all of the elections that have taken place in Egypt. This is a period of real difficulty in figuring out what we can do, and so far we haven't shown the imagination required in using our resources to push an agenda that's really in our in all of our interests. The only way to fight al-Qaeda at the end of the day and all of the extremist forces is to create political alternatives that will attract the majority of people.
Well, let's listen to a voter named Salma al-Badri. She was talking to the Associated Press on Monday, which was the first day of these elections, and she was making the argument that women in particular are enthusiastic about this election, and she was very excited about voting for General Sisi, saying that a vote for peace for him is a vote for peace and stability for Egypt.
Women have sacrificed a lot for this day. They gave a lot of their time. Some of them even sacrificed their children. And it's really wonderful that we've seen this day today. So I hope it turns out well.
So Shadi Hamid, the reason I bring that up is that there's a sort of premise to the conversation that that General Sisi is a strong man and not popular, and yet there are people out there voting for him, and he does have a following. Who are the people who, like that woman, who would be behind what she says that General Sisi stands for, which is stability, the same thing President Obama seems to have a hankering for?
So there's no doubt that Sisi is a strong man, but he's a strong man who enjoys considerable popular support. Millions of Egyptians, we can disagree how much exactly, passionately, enthusiastically support Sisi and see him as some kind of savior. This actually makes things more scary because we're not just talking about an autocrat. We're talking about an autocrat that has a real base of popular support. And some of his supporters are even more hardline than he is. And I think more generally, you have this odd phenomenon of near unanimous support from so-called liberals for the military coup. Some of them have come to their senses since then, but there still are a lot of liberals who support this crackdown. And I think the bigger issue here underlying a lot of this is there's a fundamental ideological divide in Egyptian society and in the Middle East more generally about the role of religion in politics, the nature of the nation state, the identity of the state. And that's where I think Egypt is different than the Latin American transitions, where the primary divide was economic. And you can have a real tangible discussion about economic interests, but the divide in Egypt and elsewhere, it's almost metaphysical. It's about the very foundations of the state. And Egyptians just haven't been able to come to a consensus on those basic questions. And that makes this a very much a zero-sum game, a very high-stakes battle. And this is actually one of the major issues I talk about in my book, is how to understand these different conceptions of the nation and how they're clashing with each other. Islamists have a distinctive vision for Egyptian society, but perhaps people like the voter we just heard from have a very different vision. And the question is, how can they find a way to live together and respect the other person's rights? And that's still an open question in the case of Egypt.
Here is Tom calling in from Cairo, Egypt. Hi, Tom. You're on Point.
Hi. I can second everything that's being said, particularly about the support for Sisi.
Tom, can I stop you a second? What puts you in Egypt at the moment?
I'm studying Arabic.
Okay. So you've been watching things up close.
I'm in a private school, and I brought up the subject of Morsi and Sisi with my teachers during a lunch break, and a lot of them were very vehement about the whole subject, and so I kind of backed off. I asked, like, what was so bad about Morsi? Did he ban alcohol? Did he make everybody wear the veil? And, like, they acknowledged that didn't happen, but they say he was going to do that. And it just seems...
And what are they saying? What are they saying about Sisi?
Well, most of them, like, either they're being quiet or they like Sisi. I mean, nobody, the other guy, Sabahi, doesn't seem to enjoy a lot of support. And there's no real alternative to Sisi. And all the lampposts have posters of Sisi, and most of the businesses have pictures of Sisi. And everywhere you go, there's pictures of Sisi everywhere. So even on the highways, on the lampposts.
All right, Tom, thanks for making the call in from Cairo. And Robin Wright at the Institute for Peace, you've lived in these countries. What does it mean that a leader's photograph is all over the place?
Well, it's very striking that General Sisi has actually developed more of a cult than Hosni Mubarak has. And in some ways, he is popular in part because there's no alternative. He hasn't allowed any alternatives. And I want to take exception to one of the things Shadi said about Egypt or the Middle East being different because of the relationship between politics and Islam. You know, throughout history, the modern era, as the countries throughout the world have gone through transitions, religion has often played the role of defining goals. It's filled a vacuum in political absence. It's formed the basis or created the ideals and values by which to judge what alternatives people want. That was true of liberation theology in Latin America. It was true of our own American history, whether it's the Puritans and the Huguenots. It's true of the Jewish refuseniks in the Soviet Union and the Christian-based communities in Eastern Europe. It's true today in Tibet with the Dalai Lama. It was true in South Africa when I lived there, where Desmond Tutu played the role of a leader when Nelson Mandela was imprisoned. Religion often plays a role, and it is true that Islam has a more say on the role of law in politics, perhaps, than other religions do. But I think that by indicating that the Middle East is an exception, we think that it's going to be different in the way it evolves or should evolve. And I think that I hope we move beyond that debate.
Okay, Robin, thanks for that point. And Shadi, as we wrap up, I mean, I just want a little bit of a sense of a bottom line as we look at this election taking place in Egypt and looking like something of a failure. Desire has just been pointed out of millions of people actually to vote for the strong man. It was considered an insulting thing to say, especially during the Bush years, that the Middle East and certain countries are not ready for democracy. Is that the bottom line in this, that Egypt is not ready for democracy as we understand it in the broad sense of a system where there's one person, one vote, regular elections, lack of corruption? Are they not ready for that?
I think everyone in principle is ready for democracy, but I think it's difficult when democracy leads to outcomes that you feel are fundamentally a threat to your personal interests. And that's what happened in Egypt, where many Egyptians turned against the democratic process because they didn't want to live with the consequences of elections. And that's understandable, even though it's fundamentally a dangerous thing. But, you know, as Robin points out, we have to readjust our expectations. You can't expect a country to become a liberal democracy overnight. Mm-hmm. So people were judging Morsi, as disappointing as he was, against this ideal standard. But that's ahistorical. You don't get to that point right away. Democracy is a process. There's a lot of ups and downs. It can be bloody. And I wish that Egyptians had actually let that process move forward instead of supporting a military coup, as many of them did.
The future we didn't get to see. Shadi Hamid, thanks so much for joining us. Your new book is Temptations of Power, Islamists and a Liberal Democracy in a New Middle East. And Robin Wright, fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Woodrow Wilson International Center, great to have you with us. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.